I would say that the most important part of that emotion was its purely emotional content. And I readily acknowledge that as far as practical politics are concerned, it really evaded most of the issues.
You agree with that, Crossman, I expect too.
Yes, I think I agree with it even more strongly because I thought that the emotional content was highly dangerous. The Tories have been promising to keep the cost of living down in Britain as well as Australia. I've always thought we oughtn't to go in for competition in promising the impossible.
Yes.
And therefore I've been in favour, and this is where my chief disappointment with the conference was, in tackling the issue of wages. Because fundamentally you can't keep prices down, but you can see to it that wages rise, and rise in a controlled fashion. Now what worried me at the conference was the unwillingness of the government to face the issue of what the left wing of the party calls a national wages policy, that's to say, a socialization of wages.
Well, Crossman, isn't the difficulty this? Isn't your real problem that you have got rising prices owing to the increased cost of imports due to a stimulus in demand brought about rearmament the world over, and also by 12 months of devaluation? Isn't that the problem?
That's right.
Which your party ought to have addressed itself to, instead of, to use your own words, I think, bombinating about profits.
No, I wouldn't quite say that, because you can't address yourself to the problem of wages without addressing yourself to the problem of profits. I don't like bombination about profits, but it's clear that if you're going to have a wages policy, you must have a profits policy too.
Well, now, I know that Sir Stafford Cripps is out of the scene for the moment, but surely Sir Stafford Cripps made it clear on numerous occasions in the House of Commons and elsewhere, that these problems couldn't be solved by placing additional taxes on profits or what is popularly known as the policy of soaking the rich. Wasn't that what he said, Edelman?
Well, he said, I think, something of that kind, but at the same time, it's quite clear that although further taxation will not be able to pay for the whole of the increased cost of rearmament, it is quite clear that with the new defence programme, there are going to be increased profits, and it's only fair and proper that an important share of those profits should go back to the nation and be used for national purposes. And therefore, I personally still consider that there is a wide area of profits which can be taken by the government for the purposes of defence. And in addition to that, I think that we must seriously consider the question of a capital levy. Because after all, when Rome was in danger, the matrons went along and threw their wedding rings on the contributory pile. And I think it only right that today, when the country is in danger, after all, that's why we're rearming, that there should be some kind of levy of that kind.
When the matrons threw their rings for the common good, there was no discrimination according to amount. Everybody gave what they had. Do I take it then from your analogy that the Labour Party policy is to apply a universal capital levy without distinction or limitation as to amount?
Well, we have to remember that
Crossman, you would rather answer.
Yes, the vast majority of people in this country don't own any capital. It's owned by relatively few people.
Well, Crossman, isn't it right to say that most people own a certain amount, whether it be in chattel,
right,
or perhaps in a house or other things? Anyway, they own more than the Roman matron's wedding ring. Now, are they to have the levy imposed on them as a result of Margate, or are they not?
Well, to begin with, of course, Margate didn't decide for or against the capital levy. And we were discussing, Edelman and I were discussing what our views were rather than Margate. Margate only made it clear that the cost of rearmament, part of it, will be taken out of what I prefer to call not capital, but unearned income. Indeed, I think one of the things we're pressing for is a much sharper discrimination between earned and unearned income, much heavier taxation on unearned income, and if possible, lighter taxation on earned income. Now that, of course, does in fact mean levying on capital. I quite agree, it's deliberately trying to tax those with capital rather than those with earnings.
Well, is it right to say, before we leave the subject of capital levy, that here again, the confluence leaves the party with certain emotional decisions, but with no signposts to indicate how they can be translated into effect.
Well,
do you agree, Edelman?
No, I would certainly call that a signpost, but it's a signpost which hasn't got the mileage on it.
It's not a chart.
It's not a map. No.
It is an indication of a goal, but not a description of the method of getting there.
That's perfectly fair.
Well, now, at the conference, it seems that a lot of misgivings were expressed on certain matters which have always loomed very large in socialist policy, notably, perhaps, in the nationalized industries. Now, wasn't it a fact that at the conference there was a great deal of criticism of the conduct and operation of nationalized industries, and not least of the status of the worker within
that government? Well, my complaint was that there wasn't enough, because as a matter of fact...
But there was a lot.
That discussion was closed by the moving of a previous question, so that it was stopped halfway through.
Well, now, Crossman, wasn't that because the chairman of your conference realized that the platform would be very hard put to it to give an answer,
and therefore accepted the
motion to put the previous question?
I wouldn't say so. My impression was that the platform was very angry at not getting an answer.
Yes.
And this was one of those unfortunate snap decisions which did nobody any good, because the platform was denied the chance of answering the allegations from the floor.
Yes.
You don't think that it was a spurious or specious indignation, and that secretly they were relieved at being exempt from the difficulty of explaining why nationalisation has not worked better in practice?
No, because this is really a most important problem which the movement is trying to face up to properly. And Morrison in particular, he's emphasised time after time that what we must have in our nationalised industry, first of all, better administration, and secondly, more industrial democracy. Now, at the conference, the criticisms that I heard principally were those which concern industrial democracy. The fact that the worker in the nationalized industry, he really wanted to feel that he was playing a part in the thing and wasn't merely at the mercy of a bureaucrat. Those were criticisms which were advanced, they were heard sympathetically, and I'm quite convinced that the platform was most anxious to answer them.
But at any rate, no answer has been given to these many problems and criticisms which have been voiced not only at your conference, but in all sorts of quarters since nationalisation took effect.
Oh, well, to some extent, Walker Smith, the answer was given actually on the day afterwards when Morrison and Bevan made their big speeches on the party document. Yes. And, of course, as you may have heard, Bevan made a very amusing reply when he said, after all, socialism was not brought about by the Immaculate Conception, and we're bound to have lots of mistakes in socialism, and we'll rectify them. And the conference did on the next day discuss a good deal of the principles on which we should go in making the nationalized industries a success.
Well, it isn't for me to comment on the taste of Mr. Bevan in the employment of his metaphors, but since you have mentioned Mr. Bevan, may I put this point to you? Wasn't there a great deal of criticism in regard to Mr. Bevan's progress with housing? Edelman?
Yes, there was. And after all, we all know that the housing problem in this country is a most grievous one. We know it, De Crossman and I know it particularly in Coventry. But it's a problem which is obviously conditioned by the availability of materials and the availability of labour. And Bevan showed to the complete satisfaction of the conference when he finished his speech, despite criticisms that had gone before, that whatever other policy were adopted, with the materials and labour available, not a single extra house could be built.
But isn't the criticism very important for this reason? Isn't it true to say of the Labour Party that they'll always cheer Anar and Bevan on all the matters that they don't understand, but that on the question of housing, which they do know something about, they realize his shortcomings as a practical administrator?
I should have said, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, almost exactly the opposite occurred. The remarkable fact was that Anar and Bevan's response to the housing debate was his greatest success of the conference.
Yes.
Well, but isn't it this, that so far as the abstractions of socialism are concerned, your party are still in the stage of throwing their caps in the air,
But so far as housing is concerned, at least they're throwing their caps into the ring. And if he doesn't succeed better in a year or two, he will be forfeiting the popularity which at present he holds.
I put it rather differently, Walker Smith. Anybody can announce housing targets, and any party can say, I'll build you so many 100,000 extra houses, if they're in opposition. But a party which is in power knows that you've got a certain amount of labor and material to allocate, and if you build more houses, you'll build fewer schools and fewer electric generating stations. I think the Labour Party has learnt the lesson, but it's no good baying for the moon. You've got to study, as Anar and Bevan said, the language of priorities. And they, on the whole, accept the view that having too few houses is better than having no work. They'd rather see factories built they can work in and be a bit overcrowded than have more houses built and no work. And that, of course, appeals much more to a working-class party than it does for a party which derived its strength from other classes.
Well, Crossman, I wish we had time to canvass these matters in detail, especially this question of housing, on which many people feel that socialism has had one of its greatest practical failures. But as time is now getting short, I think we should try and sum up the general trend of your conference. So may I ask this? Do you consider that, on the whole, the conference marked a progress to the right or the left for the future of the party? What do you say, Edelman?
Well, Morrison said the other day that that in order to fly, you must have two wings, and I think that is true of the Labour Party. Our wings of the party, there is certainly a right and a left. They have worked harmoniously, and I would say that the party has taken off into 1950 with even greater strength than in the past 5 years.
I see. So at Margate, you evolved a new political technique of flying on the fence, I suppose. What do you say, Crossman?
Well, I should say that the biggest fact about Margate was the ascendancy of the Prime Minister. I shouldn't think any man, including Churchill during the war, enjoys such a personal ascendance as he does today. And the curious thing about Attlee is that he incorporates the idealism of the left and the practicality of the right. Mm. And we're pretty lucky to have this center so solid and so capable as we've got it today.
But I suppose, in spite of that, you as a keep leftist would claim that the results of the elections to committees and so on showed a lurch to the left on the part of the party. Would you agree, Crossman, for example, that the elections to committees show the trend better than debates, because whereas debates are stage managed from the platform, elections are free?
I should say they show not a trend, but a desire. The party desperately wants to fulfill its vision of socialism. It's put people on to committees from the left. On the other hand, I say what I said at the beginning. It doesn't have a very clear idea how to get there. And if it doesn't, you know, the right usually gets its full share of the policy.
Well, and if I may quote Bevan, when it comes to a showdown, there's unity on the battlefield.
But would you, well, if you use the metaphor of the battlefield, would you agree from what you've said that really the Labour Party in Britain is now in a sort of no man's land, halfway between the comfortable old doctrines which have been left behind and working out real policies and programs to deal constructively with the difficult future that lies ahead?
No, I don't agree with that. I think that until recently, the Labour Party was rather like a younger son who'd squandered his paternal inheritance and was really living rather beyond his intellectual means, something like the Tory party. But I think that now we've got a whole set of new ideas, we've revived our own principles, and we are going ahead.
Well, we've heard both Crossman and Edelman as representing left and right of the Labour Party. You may not necessarily think they've satisfactorily explained everything, but at least they have an answer to every question I have put to them.
That was London Forum. a transcribed program. The speakers were Richard Crossman, Maurice Edelman, and Derek Walker-Smith. And this is the British Broadcasting Corporation.